I think that writing also is among the things that helped me think this through and get there. And then when I finished my degree, I was actually very pessimistic. I had no idea that at close to age 55, 56, that a psychoanalytic institute would even consider me. But I did decide to take the leap, and I ended up going to BIPC, and here I am.
The training time was, I remember it as a time of discovering, you know, the books, we read the authors I knew, and what was happening to me also at that moment. What kind of an analyst would I be during and after the training? And my background, how can I say, encouraged me to go on when it was difficult, to go on searching for the truth, searching for the knowledge, but the knowledge about myself, no, during the training. And it went on in my actual train analysis.
Welcome to the Psychoanalysis On and Off the Couch podcast. For the past few years, we've been speaking with analysts from around the world who've been applying their analytic way of thinking, not only to their offices, but also off the couch, in venues external to their consulting rooms. We've spoken to analysts who work in hospitals, in prisons, in community health centers, in refugee clinics, just to name a few. We've also detoured, of course, during COVID. We've spoken with analysts again from around the world to learn from our communities how they, their patients, and the analytic community in general have been dealing with this crisis. And hopefully the worst is over and we can return to our main focus. We can return to speaking to analysts who are bringing their skills to people who otherwise would never see the inside of an analyst's office. In addition to that, we're speaking with the elders of our field, people who have been practicing this craft for 40 and 50, sometimes longer years, to learn from them what they have to teach us, not only about this piece of history that we're all living through, but their reflections on our field. Please visit us at our website, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can leave a comment, where you can subscribe. I hope you find these conversations thoughtful and meaningful. And I appreciate your listening. Thank you. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz, and my two guests today are Susanna Merlo from Buenos Aires and Ellen Pinsky from Cambridge, Massachusetts. What they both share is a background in the world of education. They each were teachers, and they each made a transition to train as psychoanalysts. And we discuss what it means to bring that background to one's work as a psychoanalyst. Susanna is a member of the Asociación Psicoanalítica de Buenos Aires, and she holds a position as an associate professor at their university, where she teaches Introduction to the Ideas of Melanie Klein in the English School. In addition to being a teacher, she provided school psychological services in school settings for 15 years. Now, she provides therapy to children, adolescents, and adults in a private clinic settings, and she holds two university degrees in school psychology and clinical psychology. Ellen comes to psychoanalysis after being a middle school teacher for 25 years. She says her experience in the classroom with 12 and 13-year-olds prepared her very well to do clinical work. She wrote a book entitled Death and Fallibility in the Psychoanalytic Encounter, Mortal Gifts. And she awarded the Deutsch Prize at her institute, the Boston Psychoanalytic Society and Institute, for her essay, The Olympian Delusion, which was published in JAPA. I hope you enjoyed this conversation. I learned a lot. We come to some conclusions about what it means to bring the different backgrounds that we all bring. It's not a subject often spoken about in our field. It's somewhat delicate, and I think we shed some fresh light on what is often unspoken and come to a rich, meaningful understanding of our backgrounds and how it influences our clinical work. I hope you enjoy it. And here is my conversation with Ellen Pinsky and Susanna Merlo. Susanna and Ellen, welcome to the podcast. It's so good to have you both here. We know that the traditional path to becoming a psychoanalyst involves finishing a psychiatric residency or completing advanced training in psychology or social work. But we also know that there are many of our colleagues, many of our esteemed colleagues, who haven't traveled that route, who have had other professions before becoming psychoanalysts and have made changes in their lives. And often that part of their thinking, their work, and their history is not often heard. And I thought it would be of use if we began to know our colleagues who come from these different journeys, and especially to know them not only in one country, but throughout the IPA world. And some of the reasons to know this and to speak of it and share it is, number one, to offer guidance to some people who may be thinking of making such a switch, to know people who have, to know the obstacles and advantages and disadvantages to doing that, and also to learn what particular contributions people from these other backgrounds have to make to our work. So, how good to begin from the world of education. Both of you in your respective countries, Ellen in the States and Susanna in Argentina, have come from particular aspects of the world of education. And why don't we begin, alphabetically, Susanna, with you starting, with your sharing with us what your work was before you began psychoanalytic training, and what you felt the influences were in doing that work that led you to make that major life choice.
Yes. Thank you, Harvey. And I am very pleased to be here sharing this space with Ellen and her experience also. Well, the first career I chose is psychopedagogist. It's a career in Argentina, like your psychology school psychology, I think. And I was working at a school while I was finishing it, and I was working as an English teacher for very young kids.
How old were the children? 6 and 7 year old, you were teaching English.
Yes, 6 and 7 years, Harvey. Yeah. They were very young. And while I was studying and working there, I realized, or I thought, that there was something else that didn't allow children to learn. I didn't know what it was, but I thought that with all the tools that my career was giving to me, it wasn't enough. At that time, I was having my first analysis, psychoanalysis, and I realized that I would like to go deeper about learning, not to learn, to learn more, to know more about the process of learning. And at that time, I read something, a paper, a Beyonce paper, about Fanchon Reverie and his model of the mind, about containment and content, container, continent, and content model. So his ideas about the mind is formed in a link, with another mind in a bond, at the beginning with the mother, and that the thoughts are built with another. So I thought it would be very good for me to study psychology and later to do the training in the institution where I belong to.
Okay, so the pieces as I hear them is that you were a teacher of five-year-olds, you were in your own analysis, and I'm presuming that your own analytic experience made accessible the notion of what deeper is, because ordinarily people don't often have a feel for that until they discover it in themselves. And then they say, as many of us have felt, oh, there's a whole world there that I didn't know about. Yeah. Yes. And you, go ahead.
Yes, especially, Herbie, I think now I can say that I was realizing that the psychoanalysis is a way of thinking, no? A way of knowing more about yourself. And I think that this was the most important reason that took me to the college to study psychology.
Now, in Argentina, tell me if I have this right, when you study psychology, that almost always includes studying psychoanalysis. Is that correct?
Yes. Especially,
because that's not the case elsewhere.
No, especially not so much now, Harvey and Ellen. Yeah. At this time, cognitive psychology is more in the classrooms of psychology than psychoanalysis. No, people have to choose to study psychoanalysis during the university. When I studied, it wasn't like that. The most subject we have to study was psychoanalysis.
I see. Are you saying, though, because it was so available and assumed, that was what led you or would have led you to choose it? Or was it that you were in your own analysis and you saw that as a pathway to, as you say, deeper? And you would have chosen it anyway.
Yes.
You would have, yeah. Okay.
Yes, yes. I think so.
Uh-huh. Ellen, let's, on the other half of the world, tell us about your experience.
How far back can I go, Harvey?
It's an open-ended question.
Let's see. Okay, so I will go kind of way back. I was a very, very shy child, and always a reader. I think that my interest in reading, it had to do very early with trying to figure out what the story was, who the characters were, what people were like. When I was 12 or 13, I was asthmatic, and our family practitioner came to the house to check me out. This is a story that I have no memory of, but that my mother told me many, many, many years later as she was failing. She told me that this had happened. And it was when I told her I was going to go back to school that I wanted to be a clinician. She said that when I was 13 and the doctor came to the house, when he was checking me out, he said, Ellen, what do you want to be when you grow up? And my mother said that I said, I want to be a psychiatrist. I have no memory of that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I said to my mother at the time, and he said, oh, do you know how hard that would be? That would be a very, very hard thing to do. I don't know that. Why? Yeah. And I said to my mother, what did you say? Remember, I was very shy. And my mother said, I didn't say anything. You are always very shy like that. Okay. So that's where I learned, not all that many years ago, my mother died shortly after, but I learned that apparently when I was 13, I wanted to be a psychiatrist. Okay. When I was into my early 20s, I continued to be a reader always. And a pretty good student, a good writer. I had two children quite young. I had two children. By the time I was 25, I had two small children. However, in that period, I became increasingly interested, kind of obsessed, with reading everything I could get my hands on about child development. And I also read Erikson in that period. And I know that I was blown away by it. And a couple of years later, I wanted also to go to medical school. And again, I was told, no, you can't do that. You have two small children, and so on. Then I came into teaching. I was in the classroom for over 20 years with 12 and 13-year-olds. And I do think that in terms of my interest in development, in children's development, I think that those kids taught me an awful lot. And I continued to learn from them. Then when I was in my 40s, I'm getting there, Harvey. When I was in my 40s, I, for the first time, consulted a psychiatrist. He happened to be an analyst. And I got into a treatment when I was about 46, for the first time in my life, for a number of reasons. But I was incredibly, it was a very powerful experience, and I wanted to understand what was happening to me. So being a reader, I then dove obsessionally into the psychoanalytic literature. I had no thought at that time of becoming a clinician myself, although that did develop an interest in that in those years between age 40 and 50. I went back to school when I was 50 to explore what it would be to get a clinical degree. I think that my success in the classroom with 12 and 13-year-olds, in a way, was a kind of clinical work that I was already doing, and I was interested in what doing, you know, one-on-one clinical work with children particularly would be. Okay, and then in the course of that first year back in graduate school, that person I was working with, that psychiatrist, he died very suddenly. And I do feel, looking back, that that's what I had no thought of being a psychoanalyst when I went back to school. I wanted to do clinical work, but I wasn't thinking about being a psychoanalyst. And I think that when that person died, it sort of catapulted me in a way into opening up the question of what would it be to be a psychoanalyst. And if I could do that and understand something about that, I would also be learning something. I would be grieving. It would be, in a way, a process of retrieving that person. So there it was. When I finished my graduate degree, I was fortunate that it was a program that required very serious writing. So I wrote a doctoral dissertation that I read the literature. It was in the 90s. I was steeped in, for example, reading Owen Rennick's work at the time. And I read the classical writers. And I also would add, Harvey, I'm almost done here, that I think that writing also is among the things that helped me think this through and get there. And then when I finished my degree, I was actually very pessimistic. I had no idea that at close to age 55, 56, that a psychoanalytic institute would even consider me. But I did decide to take the leap, and I ended up going to BIPSI, and here I am.
What's striking about both of your stories, there are obviously common themes. First and foremost, the essential inspiration, to call it that, of being in one's own treatment and discovering the power of it. But also quickly linked in for both of you is the importance of reading. Susanna, you mentioned Bion right off the top of your head, and certainly Ellen, reading has been vital for you from earlier years. And writing.
Increasingly.
Let's segue over to what the training was like for each of you, given your backgrounds. But let's start, Ellen, if you can bring forward what you've shared with me, which is what Ella Freeman Sharp thought would be a useful examination or an evaluation of people applying for training, given her own humanities background and given your common interest in that area.
Can I just read what's in
yes,
the?
Sure.
Yeah. Okay. I'm going to start a few lines before the Ella Freeman Sharp. So what I'm doing here is I am speaking to an imagined candidate, psychoanalytic candidate, in the year 2020 when I wrote this. And this is what I say to the imagined candidate. I encourage you to fall in love with the writers, to treasure the texts, to read, read, read. Be curious, learn the language, try on different theories, but at the same time, be suspicious of jargon and bandwagons. Strive always to use plain words. The unconscious, after all, nestles in the body, not in polysyllabic technical terms. I'll let Ella conclude. Let me conclude with my most recent capsule edition, a passage by the especially fine writer and master teacher, Ella Freeman Sharp, almost 100 years ago, on qualifying as an analyst. And this is what she wrote. I think it was in 1930. In any reading for analytic qualification, I would make compulsory the following books: Nursery Rhymes, the Alice books, Hunting of the Snark, Grimm, Andersen, the Brer Rabbit books, Water Babies, Struwwelpeter, Undine, Rumpelstiltskin, Peter Ibbotson, Greek myths and tragedies, Shakespeare's plays. Were I an arbiter of training, I should set an examination on those books as a final test by which the would-be analyst should stand or fall. My final examination for qualification would run along these lines. 1. Quote in full a verse in which London Bridge is falling down occurs. 2. Give briefly the story of three blind mice. 3. If the mice were blind, how came they to run after the farmer's wife so purposely? Account for the cutting off of their tails. Illustrate what unconscious drama is being staged when a patient thinks of himself as one of the three blind mice. What inference concerning the health of the ego do you draw from the fact that the tails were cut off instead of the mice being killed? Somewhere in that list of immortal stories, we shall all find an unconscious fantasy of our own. To understand even the tale of the three blind mice is to have a conception of what those crystallized terms id, ego, and superego really mean in terms of the drama of life. So I won't read the rest, but...
Okay, thank you for that. Susanna, walk us through your experience as a candidate and what it was like coming from your background in education. You know, it's an interesting question, our professional training. I suspect we all privately carry with us the notion that our own particular brand of training is better than the other brands of training, that, you know, MDs have a background that they think is more useful, likewise psychologists, and also for people who come from outside the clinical world, the educational world. I think we all harbor some defensive notions of superiority. And more than likely, each of our backgrounds has pros and cons. So let's see if we can actually have an open discussion about it. It's the kind of thing one doesn't speak of generally in public for obvious reasons. But Susanna, maybe here we can have that conversation. What's your sense of your background and how it has prepared you for clinical work?
Well, I think, I would add something about my decision of studying psychoanalysis.
Okay.
I read in Spanish Freud's work, Psychopathology of the Everyday Life. I don't know in English if it is well said.
Well, exactly. Yeah.
That was another reason that I decided to go to college to study psychology. It sounded me so great, that paper, it encouraged me to go on. But when I was teaching and when I was working with children that have difficulties in learning, I learned that a conflict is very important to as a motor of the learning. No, as I read Piaget, I studied Piaget at that time, and if there isn't a cognitive conflict, there is no learning, he said. No, and I agree with that. And I found when I began to study psychoanalysis in the training and my own teaching analytical process and the supervisions, I realized that Piaget was true. And as Melanie Klein said, the conflict is the motor of the development. No, I found that was true and good for psychoanalysis also. The training time was I remember it as a time of discovering, the books, we read the authors I knew and what was happening to me also at that moment. What kind of an analyst would I be during and after the training? And my background, how can I say, encouraged me to go on when it was difficult, to go on searching for the truth, searching for the knowledge, but the knowledge about myself, during the training, and it went on in my actual analysis. I am not sure if I was clear because I wanted to talk
perfectly clear. Yes. No, that's fine. Do you think that your way of searching for truth, whether it be inside you or inside the people you were working with, did you think that your way of searching for the truth was influenced by your exposure to working with children as you did as a teacher?
Yes.
Or whether, on the other hand, that there's something about the analytic experience that we all go through that sort of washes out the differences between whether it's an MD, PhD, educator, or whatever else.
Yes.
Which do you think it is? Do you think there are particular differences between how you search and find truths by virtue of your background?
Yes. I think that when you are a teacher, you are helping the other to find the best way to learn, for example, no? How can you help him, the tools you can give him to work with the conflict and to go on, no?
Right.
To apprehend a new knowledge object, let's say. In that way, the knowing that learning is difficult, painful, but happy also, I think it helps me in the everyday life, no? In my work and in my own process, I think. But as an analyst, I think I have to intervene in a different way. I think that I am accompanying the other, no? My patients in this hard process, and I have to be patient. I'm to let the person go on with his own process. In school, sometimes you have certain times that certain knowledge have to be acquired in a certain time. In the analytical work, there is no time. Each one has its own time.
That would be a difference, yeah.
Yes, I found this difference, no? In my personal style, I have to be more silent and be more patient.
No.
I think it's a bad thing I bring from my background, my former background. But it is the same. Sometimes I find the same happy moment, no? I remember the faces when a child discovered how to write, for example, no?
Uh-huh, yeah.
And when a patient can say, oh, I have never thought this moment or this aspect of my life in this way. I can see my life in a different way, not just I was told or yeah, as I thought before. This is a happy moment in the process, I think.
So when you facilitate maturation, either of an educational sort or a self-awareness thought, both are pleasing to you.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
Very.
Nice. Ellen, I know you have strong feelings about the differences in one's background. And
do I?
You do, yes. So let me invite you to share them.
That's too loud. Shall I turn my volume down?
No, you needn't turn your volume.
It's interesting that you say that, Harvey. First of all, let me say that I picked up on a few specific things from Susanna's response, including something about what one learns from children, and also three particular words that I jotted down about in her describing how she works. I tend to be quiet, patient, right, Susanna? And I added the word attentive.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, let me say that I can't judge. I don't know. I'd be interested in what you might say or what other MDs might say. I worked with three very skilled MDs as supervisors when I was a candidate. All of them tended to be quiet, patient, and attentive. So I'm not, they taught me a lot. I'm not sure what the differences might be. So I don't know that I can speak to that. But I can say that I think that my years in the classroom with children, and then when I went back to school, my initial interest was to work with younger and younger children, which I did do for the first 10 or 15 years. I worked with 3, 4, and 5-year-olds and totally loved it. I think that you can't do a good job in the classroom with 11 and 12-year-olds unless, first of all, you have a sense of humor, you can keep a discipline of a certain kind that keeps them in their seats, and you can get their attention. And I think that I learned in the classroom with children that age what it was to be quiet in a way that was disciplined. In other words, open it up for them to have something to do or to say. And I was very patient with early adolescent silliness and anxiety. And I tried to be as attentive as I could to what was going on with them, what was turning them on, interesting them. And I gave them very appealing, I look back on it, they told me over time, things to do in the classroom, ways to deal with, I was an English teacher, ways to deal with language and with expressing themselves that was very helpful to them. And I think that all of those things that I've just named, I hope in some kind of coherent way, also apply to how I worked clinically with people. I also think, you know, let me just add this one thing about, okay, I'll tell a family story and then I'll be done. I have two of my daughters, I have three daughters, but two of my daughters, one is a veterinarian and another is an MD, and she's actually a psychiatrist, a child psychiatrist. And my veterinarian daughter likes to tease her sister by saying the following, that she thinks that veterinarians are far more able and sensitive and good at talking to the client or the adult than MDs are overall. And her theory is that it's because you have to translate what's going on with the animal. You have to go through the animal and translate what it is that the person needs to know. What the owner of the animal needs to know. And I think that there's something in there about that triangular translating. I think of the children that I worked with in a way as having taught me something and taught me to translate in a way that possibly led to a kind of a patience and an openness to what it was that would happen clinically. Does that make sense?
Sure. I'm hearing from both of you, and tell me if I have this right, that there isn't so much you find a difference in what you bring to the analytic encounter compared to those who went straight from psychiatry or psychology or social work into analysis. Is that a fair summary?
Well, I'll jump in and then give Susanna.
Go ahead.
I don't know, Harvey. I think it all depends. I think it not only depends on the person, but it depends on the training itself. I mean, you know, I know that there are medical school programs, for example, where the medical students are actually required to write. Mm-hmm. I think that that's something that's very useful in terms of someone who would go on to do clinical work.
Right.
And as for the social workers, I actually feel a great, a closeness to the people who come out of social work school.
Uh-huh. Susanna, what's your sense? Do you think there are significant differences or it's essentially we're doing the same thing?
Yes, I don't know if we are doing the same thing, but I agree that there are no many differences. And I think it has to do, maybe, no, that's my point of view, that some in our former professions, something has impacted us that made us to think deeper, maybe coming from medicine, that there is something else, no, in a symptom, in what we are working with, I think. And we choose the psychoanalysis to go to it, to understand it.
So maybe it's not the professions that define the way we work with analysands, but each of us who are drawn to psychoanalysis independent of the profession.
I think that's true overall.
Yes, it depends on our history, our story, our personality, no?
Right. Yeah, it's a good point. Let's talk about favorite reading. I have asked you both to include, and there will be on the notes to the podcast, your favorite readings. Susanna, why don't we start off with you? What can you tell us about the readings that have really made an impact on you? You started off with Beyond.
Okay. I didn't include Freud because I think that I realized later, but I think because he in the base of all these authors, no? But when I have talked about Beyond, I included Learning from the Experience. It is a book, I think it's very important book, especially. He talks about the tolerance to frustration, no? The intolerance to frustration, and I think it's very, when I talk about learning, I want to make something clearer. I don't talk about learning just about school's contents, no, about talking about ourselves as well and to know more of ourselves. And I think that if a person can tolerate the frustration of not knowing something, that you are not perfect, you can't learn anything. I think all the books I choose are connected, are linked, because each one of them talk about learning. I would add something about Beyond. It helps me to understand actuality, no, the reality about fanatism, thoughts, no, the difficulties that it's creating in different societies. To think about what is happening now, then I would choose Melanie Klein, Harvey.
Okay,
I will go on with Melanie Klein. I choose one of the last. Her last papers, two analysts and I teach Kleinian theory in the training of our institution, no?
Mm-hmm.
And we choose to end the work that is named, let me see, our adult world and its roots in the infancy. It's okay in English, no?
Yes.
This is one of her last papers, and I like it very much because her theory is summarized here. And, well, I will not talk about her theory. I will choose what is important for me about the learning, no? And she says at the end that it's very important if you can't admire others' qualities, you will be deprived of happiness and enrichment. I like this sentence very much because it talks about the envy, not envy, but especially we need to leave our omnipotence and omniscience fantasy to go on learning during the life. No, I think she's telling that if we don't accept we are not perfect, that we have to, she talks about the integrity, no, and to integrate our worst and best aspects to go on growing. This is what I like it very much for me.
Yes.
For my son and my daughter and my patients.
Uh-huh. I hear you. Sure.
And then shall I go on, Harvey?
Sure. Why don't you mention one more and then we'll go to some of Ellen's favorites.
One more?
Yeah.
Okay. Ooh, it's hard to choose. Well,
it's like choosing children. Yeah?
Yes. Yes. I think it's the others are included in the quote of the paper I have chosen of one of my teachers, Clara Nemas. I am studying Beyond with her now in these days. And she wrote a paper for Canada last year, and she began it. I will take the quote she took from a book of Haruki Murakami, the writer. Yes?
Okay, no, I'm not familiar with the writer.
Okay. Can I read the quote? The book is Kafka on the Shore. He wrote, "Sometimes fate is like a small sandstorm that keeps changing directions. You change direction, but the storm chases you. You turn again, but the storm adjusts. And once the storm is over, you won't remember how you made it through, how you managed to survive. You won't even be sure, in fact, whether the storm is really over. But one thing is certain, when you come out of the storm, you won't be the same person who walked in. That's what the storm's all about." Well,
thank
this is our
that.
Work, yes. I think.
Yeah, exactly. Perfectly. But both Klein's comment and that comment captures it beautifully. Ellen?
Okay. Let me also just, for the moment, bounce off something that you did, Harvey, now in talking to Susanna, that I think is an element clinically that an MD can have it, a social worker can have it, a psychologist can have it, and that is a sense of humor. It seems to me that when you said sort of sotto voce, is that correct? It's like choosing children. When you asked Susanna to choose her extra additional paper, it seems to me that that's a gift of something that happens between two people. I would never say that the analyst is a comedian or a jokester or should aim to bring that in clinically. But in my own experience of working with supervisors and also of working with, over the years, three different clinicians myself, the capacity to do something that brings humor in is essential. So that's a little bit of praise, okay? That's a nice comment, in my opinion. Okay, I this time capsule thing, yeah, I'm a close reader, by which I mean there are things when I read them, I go back and I read them again and I read them again and I read them again. And I found over the years that there were certain pieces in the psychoanalytic literature that just captivated me. And so this idea of the time capsule, what are the pieces that you would put in the time capsule, not books, but, you know, papers or parts of a book from which you could reconstruct psychoanalysis. For me, that way of thinking about the literature is part of the process of trying to understand what the weird thing is, psychoanalysis, how it works and why it works, and what would be the essentials for reconstructing it if all the literature were lost. So that's the time capsule game. And for me, I find and continue to find three things that I name by Freud that are always in my time capsule: observations on transference, love, remembering, repeating, and working through. And speaking of children and observation of children, the passage in Beyond the Pleasure Principle that tells the story of the toddler, grandson, and Fort Da. So that narrative also would be in my time capsule. And then over the years, the papers that I go back to and obsess over, you know, the Paula Hyman that's on my list, I haven't read that recently. I should go and reread it. But the Winnicott is another paper that just sort of obsesses me with how much it offers and what it offers between the lines. So shall I go on? I mean,
you don't want to leave out Lowald. I know you are a great appreciator of his work.
Lowald, yeah, in the extract, whatever you call it, that extract that I sent you and Susanna, the papers that are always in my time capsule, it does include Lowald's On the Therapeutic Action of Psychoanalysis, 1960. And for me, among the many reasons that paper is so important, aside from the fact that once one studies it, even though it's a little dense, it's actually gorgeously thoughtfully written, which always means a lot to me. And Lowald brings into American psychoanalysis very strongly the idea of the relationship. Where does it start from the get-go? It's the mother-child, call it the caretaker, infant relationship. And he also brings into the literature in a way that is acceptable the word love. And there's a wonderful sentence, which I almost have by heart still, where it talks about when one is doing clinical work and paying attention to the person who's in the room and doing a good job of that, it's a form of love and respect for that person and that person's individual development. And for me, bringing that word love in a way, and, you know, Freud also brings it in. For me, it's very important. And it humanizes things in a way that just matters to me.
Well, without having used the word up to this point, both you and Susanna describe analysis as a gift, a gift that is given, a gift that is shared, a gift for both people. It's not only the patient who goes through these changes.
It is actually the title of my my book, my collection of essays, Mortal Gifts. Well, they made me make it the subtitle because the search engines wouldn't go to Mortal Gifts. It was originally supposed to be the title.
But we know it's a gift, and it's a gift for both parties. Yes. Just to add to your comment about the time capsule, that's from a note that you write in a book edited by Fred Bush. Fred and I had a conversation about that book. It's episode 89. It's called Wisdom and Enthusiasm for Today's Candidates. I recommend the book, and I recommend Ellen's piece in the book. Before we close, I'd like to ask both of you, you're at different points in your careers. Ellen, you're now retired, and you're obviously representing different parts of the analytic world. Let's talk about the future. Susanna, you mentioned now that psychology programs in Argentina offer a choice, not just psychoanalysis. Well, that may be not a good thing, or it may be a fine thing. Psychology is a big world, and I don't think learning other things has to take away from also learning and appreciating and understanding analysis. But what do you think? What do you see in the future in the Argentinian world?
Well, I sometimes think that it will not disappear. Psychoanalysis will not die because
that's a low bar.
What?
That's to say it won't disappear is a heck of a way to begin. What do you see as the future?
Yes, no. Because sometimes Okay. Here we have the arguments that saying that it will die, will not survive these times, but I don't think so. And yes, and because as I said before, I think it's a way of living, of thinking. And it will not, it will go on. But now we have lots of different offers to answer these questions. But they offer different things. No, they offer some, I think, as I see them, superficial thoughts, and they give you certain tools to go on, but I think they are not in touch with people's concerns and sorrows. No, and I think psychoanalysis can do this very well. And okay. I think it will go, maybe it has to be transformed. I think psychoanalysis, just in the consulting room as it used to be, will not be possible. I think psychoanalysis has to be in the community, schools, hospitals, to have a more presence there, no? And includes maybe another disciplines, anthropology, philosophy, to give answer to the new things that are new parenthoods, sexuality, gender questions. I think that psychoanalysis has a lot to say about this, no?
As the saying goes, both on and off the couch. Ellen, the future?
Yeah. Is my sigh there not unlike how Susanna began that you
yeah covered. Yeah right both beginning pessimistically yeah
you know, last night I happened to have been watching an episode of, do you know John Oliver's program? That's anyway,
yeah,
John Oliver did a program last night on the mental health crisis in this country. And I recommend it for how wonderfully done it was and how horrifying it is about how little is available for people who need somebody to talk to. That said, I think that I agree with Susanna. I don't think it's going to go away in a way because some version of it, I think, has been here since the beginning of people. We didn't call it psychoanalysis, but yes. Something that has to do with how people are with and toward and about each other, communication. I also think that in terms of American psychoanalysis, I think that, I have relatively little at this point, Harvey, to do with the American, but in my view, the tendency within the American, as I still understand it, to want to throw Freud out and go totally toward, people call it different things, the intersubjective, the relational, whatever, and that Freud was just wrong and kind of bad. To me, that is, I think that Freud is much too easily dismissed today. And as an educator, it strikes me that erasure, it tends to be erased, is part of what jeopardizes the discipline. And there's such a paradox in that because the process itself is supposed to be about understanding something about the history. So, you know, I'll just end with that. I think that it's a real pity. And I hope that Freud is not erased.
Mm.
Well, I want to thank you both. I have learned from listening to you, and especially around the issue of people coming from different backgrounds and what they contribute to our field, and the nature of the work that you do, and how you bring your interests, and that's helped me, because I don't know many educators who are now practicing analysts, and I now know too better than I did a while ago, and I'm grateful for that, and that's probably true for many of our listeners.
You go, Susanna.
And we're going to talk to other people who come from other professions and see what we can learn from these different perspectives. But I'm grateful for your spending time. Thank you for participating. And I look forward to our keeping in touch.
Thank you, Harvey. A pleasure to get to know you a little bit, Susanna.
I will put, can you see me now to say goodbye?
Yes, now I can see you. Yes.
Okay. Yes.
Okay.
I want to thank you, Harvey, for inviting me. And Ellen, I will read Ghost in the Nurseries, the book you proposed. And it was very nice to meet you. Very nice.
Be nice to lift the glass, okay?
Thank you both.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.